Everyone's experience is unique to them. This podcast contains the personal story, experience, and opinions of the speaker, rather than that of Breast Cancer Now. Hello and welcome to the Breast Cancer Now podcast. This is a series that shares the stories of people who have had breast cancer. It's also where you'll hear the voices of our nurses, researchers, and experts who help to provide support for today and hope for the future to anyone affected by breast cancer. Hello, I'm Em, and today I'll be speaking with Tony. A decade ago, Tony found out that he was one of around 370 men in the UK each year to be diagnosed with breast cancer. He has since gone on to support others with breast cancer and has even appeared at Breast Cancer Now fundraising events. Tony, thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
I wonder if you could please start by just telling me a little bit about your diagnosis and your treatment.
Yes. It all started when we were on a holiday in Namibia. And we had hired a 4x4 vehicle and we were bouncing around on unmade roads and tracks, visiting places in the Kalahari Desert and the Namib Desert.
Nice.
And whilst we were doing it, I felt a soreness on my right nipple. Mm. Basically, I just put it down to the friction of the seatbelt rubbing against the nipple, and that's what I thought it was. This was in August 2010. We came home and the nipple was still sore for about a couple of months. And in October, I discovered a lump underneath the nipple. I hadn't told my wife anything about this at all. I Googled it. And I was vaguely aware that men could get breast cancer. And when I Googled it, it was one of the options. But it seemed so unlikely, I just assumed it was a cyst, basically, and ignored it. Anyway, time went on, and just after Christmas 2010, we were sitting on the settee, and I can't remember exactly what happened, but my wife whacked me across the chest.
Lovely.
That must have been being cheeky somehow. And she felt this lump, and she said, "What's that?" I said, "Well, nothing." And she said, "Yes, it is." And she felt it, and she said, You best get down to the GP and get it checked out." So very early in the new year, I went down to the GP, and he checked it out, and he said, "I don't think it's anything serious, but I'll send you down to the breast clinic just to have it checked," which is what happened. About 10 days later, I went to the breast clinic, and there was a GP who was helping out on the breast clinic at the time. And they hadn't got any ultrasound equipment working, but she sort of felt it, and I could tell by her face that it was something serious and something unusual. And she went off to talk to the consultant and came back and said, we want to give you a needle biopsy. So they did that, and then 10 days later, I was called back into the hospital and saw the consultant. And he then told me it was breast cancer, but he needed to do a core biopsy, which he did. And about another 10 days later, I went back to the hospital for the results of that. And he said it was grade 3 invasive ductal carcinoma, that I would need an operation, a mastectomy. And this was on a Tuesday. And he said, "I can do it on Friday."
Wow. Prompt.
Which was fantastic, but slightly worrying in terms of,
yeah, of course.
You know, you think, well, if they can do it that quick, it must be sort of very serious. I just felt at one stage that every time I went to the hospital, I was getting worse and worse news. And it was that time when I thought, well, I can't think too far ahead on this. I've just got to take it each step at a time. My wife was tremendously supportive to me, and she looked everything upon the internet and read all the leaflets from Breast Cancer Now and National Health and whatever. And so when I was having chemo, if I said, "Oh, my fingernails are hurting," or "My teeth are hurting," or anything like that, "Oh, it's all right, it's one of the side effects, I've read all about it, you'll be okay." So I didn't do any research like that. I left her to do it, and I just tried to deal with it, myself, with her help. Anyway, they were excellent at the hospital, and they talked it over with us, and we I went in on the Friday and had a mastectomy, which was fine. And I think, I've not really got a problem with altering my body shape or anything like that. So I didn't have those psychological problems that a lot of ladies probably have with body shape alteration. Mm. So everything went fine on that. But he then told me that I've got to have chemotherapy. It had spread into my lymph nodes, so I've got to have a lymph node removal. And I would have to have radiotherapy. So I had six sessions of chemotherapy, the last three being the FET-T combination, with which I was pretty ill, to be honest. I got readmitted into hospital twice with the high temperature and severe back pains. Mm. I was pretty poorly all through the chemo, really. But anyway, got through it in the end. He then performed a lymphadenectomy and took out 25 lymph nodes. And then after that, I had the radiotherapy, which was fine. I didn't have any problems with the radiotherapy. Then they put me onto tamoxifen, and that was 10 years ago, and I've suffered the same side effects, I think, that most people get with tamoxifen, in terms of hot sweats and aching joints and muscles and things like that. But they kept asking me, was I having side effects with tamoxifen? And I said, well, yeah, I think so. But, you're getting older as well. So these aches and pains, you don't know whether the drug or any other drugs I was on, or whether it's just aging, basically. So I've lived with it for 10 years and I finish in October. So I'll stop taking.
Nearly there.
Yeah, nearly there.
Yeah, well, it's not often that we get to talk to someone who is actually so far from their original diagnosis date. So it's really good to get your perspective on what has continued happening over those last 10 years. And you mentioned obviously still having, the radiotherapy affected you a few years ago when it came to other operations. And the tamoxifen is still having those side effects. Has there been anything else that, over the last 10 years, you still feel that your diagnosis or your treatment has affected you, even if it's not a physical thing? Is there still, some psychological side effects of actually having that diagnosis of breast cancer 10 years on?
It is life-changing, there's no doubt about it.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
You have a different attitude to life and to what you want to achieve in the future. It's always in the back of your mind the thought that maybe it will come back, because you're never sure. And the attitude that you have after it, that you feel that you need to do things and not put things off. Mm. And have a sort of pretty positive attitude to taking on new experiences and travel and things like that, really.
It's nice in a way then to hear that, along with those obviously very difficult side effects that you've had this kind of change of attitude that's had a more positive effect on you as well. But I understand, I hope it's okay to speak about this, but I think your sister also had a diagnosis of breast cancer as well. Is that correct?
Yes, she did. Yeah.
So you both having this prompted you to get investigated for the BRCA2 gene alteration?
Well, the breast unit were very keen for me to be tested for the BRCA2 gene, mm-hmm. because my sister had it, and it's unusual for a man to get breast cancer as well. So they were very keen for me to do that. And I went for counselling and decided I was going to do it. The counselling was fairly exhaustive, but as with a lot of these things, you don't always take everything in when they're telling you things.
Yeah, of course.
And I've got to say, I never really got into my mind the full implications of the BRCA, of being tested for BRCA. Mm. And I was really only thinking about myself, and I thought, I want to know whether I'm BRCA, I've got a BRCA gene or not, and I want to do it. So I did. I was tested, and subsequently turned out I'd got the mutated BRCA2 gene. So I thought, okay, well, I need to tell my children. And both the professor that was in charge of the gene program and my breast surgeon, were keen for me to tell my children. But my son had said he didn't want to know what the result was. So I told my daughter, and she said, well, I'm not going to get tested, but I will talk to my GP and discuss it with him.
Yeah.
And she has done, and she's had counselling, and she now gets an MRI scan every year. She's not been tested for the gene, but she has an X scan every year, mm-hmm. which basically I'm happy about.
Yeah.
Because I just feel, you know, she's being checked out, and if anything goes wrong, she'll be caught quite early. Anyway, so I was happy about her, but I was unhappy about my son. And my breast surgeon and the genetics guy were very keen for me to tell my son. And so in the end, I did, even though he told me not to. And he wasn't very happy about that. And I said to him, well, you know now that there's a chance, 50-50 chance you've got the gene. You know, I would like to do something about it, but I'm not going to hassle you about it. It's your decision. You've got to make your own mind about it. So periodically, I used to mention it to him. And then strangely, I was part of a study. The genetics professor put me on a study called the IMPACT study. It's basically, I think, run by the Institute of Cancer Research. So every year I used to go for testing for prostate cancer. Mm-hmm. And he always said to me that if you're going to get prostate cancer, I'm going to catch it early. And anyway, I went along merrily for about 7 years. And then 3 years ago, I went on a usual test, and he said, it's gone up a bit, PSA testing. And whilst it was under the sort of limit that a GP would refer you to the hospital, he actually referred me to the hospital because it had gone up. And it turned out I'd got prostate cancer, grade 3 prostate cancer.
Oh, goodness.
And I had no symptoms or anything. So it was always a case of that if he hadn't referred me, I wouldn't have been referred. Mm. I only got referred because I was on this study. And I wouldn't have been referred by my GP. And the odds are it would have been too late by the time I was referred.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
So I was only one step away from it. You know, going into grade 4 and doing metastatic and going into the rest of the body. So, that was a big bonus. So the upshot of that was that at Christmas this year, the Institute of Cancer Research was celebrating their 25 years since they discovered the BRCA2 gene. Mm. And they asked me to do a video thing for them, which I did. This was then picked up by the Guardian online and the Observer newspaper, the paper version of the Guardian, by their science editor. And he did a double page spread in the paper and published it online as well. And it wasn't just about me, it was about a lady as well and about the research into the discovery of the BRCA2 gene. Mm. But much to my amazement, my son read this article online and came back to me and said, I'm going to do something about it now, and I want some details on the genetics people to give to my doctor and everything else. So, you know, I was really pleased with that, and, you know, it was a good outcome of the thing. But what I would say is I never really considered, when I said, yes, I will be tested for the BRCA2 gene, that the implications down the line for your children.
Yeah.
And of course, now subsequently my grandchildren, because my son's got 2 little girls, 4 and 6, and I do have a bit of a guilt complex about the possibility that I've passed the gene on to those 2 little girls. But the thing I feel about that is because of all the research which is being done, you know, and a lot funded by Breast Cancer Now and other cancer charities, I feel that by the time they're grown up, and if they do contract breast cancer, the research will be such that it shouldn't be a problem to, well, it might be a bit of a problem to them, but it shouldn't be a terminal problem for them. I take a lot of solace from that, basically.
You touched on a lot of things here. One of those things you say you kind of feel guilty about having that gene and passing it on. That's obviously not something that you could control, but what you could control is taking part in this study and is, you know, actually contributing to this research that is going to help other people, potentially your grandchildren in the future. So yeah. I really hope that you don't, you know, take that guilt to heart. I think it's natural to feel that way, but your son came around eventually. I think that's very like typical of a child not wanting to do what their parents say there, but it came around eventually when the scientist stepped in and told him about it. Is there something you know now that you wish you'd been aware of before your treatment?
Well, there is actually, because I do feel that if I'd have been aware of that I'd got the BRCA2 mutation before I was originally diagnosed, I wouldn't have left it for nearly 6 months before I presented myself to the doctor. You know, I'd have been aware that the chances were only in men slightly higher of getting breast cancer, but in ladies, you know, it's tremendously higher of getting breast cancer. And it is very high that men would get prostate cancer. But I just probably wish that I'd been aware of that before I did actually contract breast cancer, because I would definitely have gone to see the doctor earlier.
Well, thank you so much for that. Could you very briefly talk about maybe the differences between when you were treated for prostate cancer and when you were treated for breast cancer? Because we obviously gender those quite a lot. And were there any noticeable differences between those?
Yes, there was. I don't necessarily know the reasons for the differences, but I mean, overall, the treatment for breast cancer is far superior to the treatment men get for prostate cancer, in my case anyway.
Yeah.
The only thing I could fault the breast cancer unit for, or the oncology that was attached to it, was the fact that as being a man in a breast cancer situation, going into a breast cancer unit, on a number of occasions it was assumed that it was my wife going for checkup or treatment. And she was approached to, can you come through, Mrs. Herbert, now? And, you know, obviously you're not reading the notes properly or something like that.
Yeah.
It is a small thing, but it's a bit irritating.
Yeah, of course.
But the treatment itself was fantastic. And to be honest, I always felt like I was a bit of a special catch in terms of, because I was a man. And the treatment was exemplary. But the thing, just go back to the prostate cancer thing as well, the difference in the treatment. I felt the prostate cancer treatment was done by ticking boxes, basically. This is for instance, I was on tamoxifen for the breast cancer, and they said, you have to have radiotherapy and you're going to a hormone treatment for the prostate cancer. I said, well, I'm already on a hormone treatment for breast cancer. Will there be any conflict between the between the two hormone treatments? And the guy sat in front of me and he actually Googled it while I sat there.
Oh God, that's reassuring, isn't it?
Yeah, it was a bit upsetting.
Yeah, goodness.
Anyway, eventually the oncology people, they sorted it all out. And the radiotherapy for prostate cancer 3 years ago, it's come down now, but it was 37 sessions. You know, as opposed to with 15 sessions for the breast cancer. And because your organs are quite close together, there's quite a good chance that, you know, they can cause damage to other organs. And indeed, that's what did happen in the end, because I do still suffer from a bit of bleeding and stuff like that. But I do, you know, I don't think it seemed to be that I'd got to suggest these things to them rather than them taking it up. Whereas I never felt like that at all with the breast cancer people. They were totally on top of the game, you know.
Yeah, I guess it is again this kind of the issue with being part of such a small group of people, of men who get breast cancer, is then it's not understood as much as it is in women. And so when you're encountering these things further down the line, you're having to advocate for yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah, whereas, you know, we've got plenty of information out there about what women should expect. And hopefully doctors wouldn't be Googling things in front of them. Should sort of know what's going on.
But I mean, you know, it's just a fact that I can't imagine that he'd ever come across a patient with prostate cancer that had already had breast cancer, because it's so unusual.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a rarity of a rarity. It was just, yeah.
That's right, yeah. So you know, probably a bit of therapy, really, but it wasn't very reassuring.
No, I can completely understand that. Not only are you having to go through the same diagnosis that, you know, thousands of women are going through, but also you're going through it feeling completely alone. You know, there's just so few other men that it must just have that extra little bit of, I think you also mentioned before that when your sister was diagnosed, she had lots of support from other women, and I don't know if she's still in contact with them now.
Yes, she is. Yeah.
Whereas you actually didn't meet anyone else, another man with breast cancer, until years later. Is that correct? Yeah. When you were actually involved in the show with Breast Cancer Now?
Well, it's only about 3.5 years after I was diagnosed, but yeah, I mean, he was the first. I've spoken to various ladies about breast cancer, obviously my sister, and there were a couple of ladies at the tennis club who had breast cancer as well. So I had conversations with them, but I hadn't spoke to a man. And whilst I think that the treatment pattern is roughly the same for men and women, there are obviously are differences in the way it affects you psychologically and that sort of way, you know, with hair loss and stuff like that. I mean, hair loss has never been a big problem to me. body shape wasn't either. So, you know, those things didn't affect me. But then things like the tamoxifen causing erectile dysfunction and that sort of thing is something that ladies don't get. And I'm not saying that I actually discussed that at the time with Clive, who I met at the fashion show, but it was very useful to chat to him and discover that basically other men, their experiences are broadly similar, but you know, some have more severe side effects than others from the drugs or from the operation or from the chemotherapy. So you know, it was good to talk to him. Subsequently, in the last 6 months, I joined a men's VDU group. We talk, as I say, every month about it. And so now I'm in contact with probably 20 men.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And we share experiences and things like that. And it's sort of a self-help group, really. Mm. Although I don't really feel that I necessarily need too much help at the moment, because I'm 10 years out and I've coped with it. But, you know, I can hope that my experience might help other people, really. That's the main thing. It does broaden out my understanding of what problems men potentially can have through the breast cancer treatment by meeting these guys, albeit only virtually.
Yeah, I'm sure they've taken some comfort as well from, you say, you know, it's not helping you as much if you're so many years on, but that's probably giving them a lot of comfort as well, and seeing, you know, you've got through it, you've come through the other side, and you are now so many years down the line in your treatment, nearly finished tamoxifen. So that must provide some comfort, some reassurance to them, and to know that they can turn to you and maybe ask you some questions that you weren't able to ask other people when you're in the same situation.
Yeah. And in fact, two of the men are people that I supported through the Someone Like Me program.
Oh, lovely.
When you finish the program, you finish your time with them, and you break that relationship, but then now I have sort of rekindled the relationship because of being on this group, basically, and I've got to say that the Someone Like Me program has given me a great deal of satisfaction from talking to men about breast cancer.
It's such a lovely thing to be there for someone when it's obviously incredibly isolating, and to show what's on the other side of treatment, and to talk them through your experiences and theirs. Thinking back to like the initial impact that treatment had on you, and kind of the ongoing impact as well, what sort of things enabled you to sort of get back on track? I think you mentioned your fitness was quite impacted. So in a blog post for us, you mentioned this.
Yeah.
How were you able to kind of get back to your fitness before, or kind of find a new level of normal for yourself?
The first thing was that while I was undergoing chemotherapy, I got selected to go for an interview to be a games maker at the 2012 Olympics.
Amazing. Okay.
And both me and my wife went to a selection interview in Coventry. But I, as I say, I was in the middle of chemotherapy and I didn't feel great that day, I'm sure. But fortunately, I got selected, and I was a games maker at Wimbledon for the tennis. So that was in the July of 2012. So I'd got sort of 7-8 months after I finished treatment to basically get myself fit for that, because it was, you know, it was quite intense. And one day you'd be showing people to the seats, another day you'd be on the gate, another day you'd be walking up and down Henman Hill, making sure everybody was all right. And, you know, so it was quite hard work. But it's had tremendous bonuses because it was a fantastic atmosphere, and you know, it was really, really a great experience. So I got that to as a goal to get fit. And also we wanted to do a quite a big walk in New Zealand on a walk called the Tongariro Crossing. And we were going to do it with my son and his girlfriend at the time, and my daughter. So we were all meeting up over there to do this walk, and then to do another great walk in New Zealand, which actually wasn't a walk, but was a 3-day canoe journey down the river.
Wow.
So that was, you know, that was something else that I needed to get fit for, really keen to do, or the whole family were keen to do, really. And I at times I had my doubts whether I'd be able to do it, but it worked okay in the end, and I did it, and we had a fantastic time. So I think it's important that when, you know, and the other things were that I played golf, I played tennis, I played badminton, and I wanted to get back to that. And my friends who I played with, the fixed fours I played with in tennis, people who were badminton, and the men I play golf with, you know, they were all encouraging me to get back to fitness so we could join back into the fixed four or join into the golf group. So support there from other people to get fit as well.
Yeah. So I guess, listening now, it's unlikely that people will be chosen to be games makers. I don't know when the Olympics will be. It feels like a lifetime ago now that it was in London.
Yeah.
I wish we could all go to New Zealand right now. Not going to happen, but one day. But what I'm hearing from that is just motivation and support. And I'm so happy for you that you had these amazing things that you could look forward to, such unique experiences. But I'm sure even those little steps of getting back to playing tennis and golf and just going back to routine was also a good motivator.
Yeah, it was. And you know, you have the exercises that you have to do when you have the operation. So, you know, you have arm exercises you have to do when you have the lymph node clearance, and the exercises you do for your chest after the mastectomy. You know, I followed those to the letter, basically, and I was keen to do them.
Mm.
A silly little story was the evening of the day I had my operation for the mastectomy. I lay in bed in a bit of a daze, really, because I was in a room on my own. And I thought to myself, you know, you get affected by the anaesthetic, and so I wasn't really on top of the game. And I lay there and thought, I've got to stop doing exercises. So I'm feeling about exercises. So I was trying to touch the wall with my arm, my bed. Less than 24 hours after the operation. And the nurse came in, and I got really told off about that.
Yeah, I can't imagine. She's like, what are you doing?
Yeah, it just shows that I was keen to do the exercise.
Oh, well, you definitely had the right attitude. I can't fault you for that.
And my wife helps as well, because she kept me up in the bar.
Oh, that's really excellent. I am really glad that you were kind of able to get back to these things, which is obvious that you really enjoy. You've taken this positivity with you to speak to other men through someone like me, now have this support group. You know, you've and also your children, whether they do encounter this or not, they've got you to talk to. And I'm sure they'll take comfort from that, you know, no matter what the outcome is. Thank you for your honesty and for sharing those experiences. This has really like been eye-opening for me personally, and I'm sure it will be for lots of people listening. Everyone's story is so different, but yours is obviously particularly unique given circumstances and then later having another diagnosis of prostate cancer. So I really appreciate you sharing that with us.
That's very kind of you. I've thoroughly enjoyed it, and I thank you for giving me the opportunity.
Thank you for listening to the Breast Cancer Now podcast. Make sure to subscribe to our channel on your preferred podcast service to hear our next episode. If you have any questions or concerns from listening today, you can find information on our research, services, and campaigning on our website at breastcancernow.org.